Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution of the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm David Gustina. Sitting in for Alan Chartok this week, our guest is Bill Mahoney. He's the Legislative Operations and Research Coordinator for the New York Public Interest Research Group. You may know it as NYPIRG. Bill Mahoney, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you.
I'll try to do my best. Obviously, Dr. Chartok is the host of this show, but we'll be able to get through it with a little help from you. Why don't we start with NYPIRG, and maybe more generally, what are the public interest research groups, the PIRGs across the country? What do they do? And then you can bring it back to New York.
Well, the public interest research groups are student-directed lobby groups, essentially, that represent the needs of students before the state legislature. It's often difficult for students to make their voices heard. They have unique concerns, such as funding for higher education, that oftentimes they may show up and talk to their legislators about it or cast a vote, but by the time they really can start to make a difference, they graduate and move on to something else in their lives. So we help give some continuity to the voice of students in the state capitol.
How do you get funded?
Through the students themselves. Each campus who wants a chapter of NYPIRG casts a vote every couple of years, and then the students pay a $3 or something like that semester fee that goes to support a full-time staffer on campus.
How aware do you think students are that these PIRGs exist and that they're there to help them?
Well, on the campuses where we have them, I think they're certainly very aware. Every fall, we register tens of thousands of voters, for example, and it's impossible to show up to classes at one of our campus chapters without seeing somebody in the hallways with a clipboard making sure they're registered to vote and telling them ways that they can get involved to fight for things that they care about.
We had a unique situation occur this election day at the University of Albany, didn't we?
Yes.
Explain that to our listeners.
Sure. There were a number of students who showed up and weren't exactly sure what their voting situation was. Some of them may have been registered downstate. Some of them may not have been registered. And some of them probably were registered in Albany, but just had some snafus in the voting books. And apparently the Board of Elections staffers who were on the site and based throughout the state were not helpful in explaining to them what exactly they should do.
And they ran out of ballots, didn't they?
Yeah, there were lines stretching for over an hour at some times, I understand. And yeah, they ran out of the affidavit ballots for students to fill out.
Let me ask you this. Have you seen an increase in the registration of students over this time, let's say since 2008?
I think that the total voter enrollment for younger people in New York State has certainly gone up compared to where it was at over earlier in the 2000s. I don't know what the cause of that might be. People might just be more involved. We have seen voter turnout increase significantly, so people might be realizing that politics do play a very important role in their lives.
And I know that some of the rules that are involved in being able to vote can come down to things like, well, you didn't put down your address, that disqualifies you. And I know there was a lawsuit over this in the lower Hudson Valley. You know, are you keeping your eyes on these rules and making sure the students do what they're supposed to do?
Yeah, well, anytime we register a student, we make sure that their form is filled out correctly and isn't missing any of the important information. And we would ultimately like to see a easier time for people to enroll. Right now, it's nearly a month ahead of the election. You need to fill out your paperwork. And some people just don't have a time to start thinking about voting until a few weeks beforehand. So we would like to see a shortening of the enrollment deadline to make it much easier for people like students to be able to participate in elections.
Well, let's stay with elections, but let's move to something that you just recently did, which is an analysis of the 2012 general election and the 2013 New York State legislature. But first, let's start with the elections, because Dr. Chartok often talks about the IPP, the Incumbent Protection Plan, and that it's very hard, including places like the old Soviet Union. We're much like that when it comes to our state legislature, and I think arguably our national elections, and that it's very hard to defeat an incumbent. And in certainly your analysis, it looks like it goes back to at least 1982, you're finding that that hasn't changed.
Yeah, this year there was reasonably high turnover compared to previous years, but we still saw only three or four incumbents defeated in the general elections for the state legislature. And this is out of 213 seats, many of which had an incumbent running for re-election.
Yeah, well, the point being that if you have the power of your seat it's going to be a lot easier for you to retain it than somebody who's a newbie, somebody who doesn't maybe have name recognition, doesn't have powerful backers, doesn't have those things that it takes to get to the point where you can compete in an election. So when you make this analysis, what are your conclusions as a result of this?
Well, there's no simple reason why incumbents have such an easy time getting reelected. You touched on a few of them. The name recognition, that's certainly a big part of it. They've been around for a few years and people have had a chance to know them. And there are state funds which they get to play a role in distributing to people throughout the state. We don't have the same member item pork system that we had had for years past, but legislators still get to show up to community groups with oversized checks handing out money from the state. And people will, of course, see, hey, you're giving money to my daughter's Little League. You must be a great guy. I like this fact that you're giving us $10,000. And that certainly helps incumbents come election day.
Well, and I certainly think that this goes to campaign finance laws and your work here. And I know, you know, that you're looking at this. What are the chances Cuomo, Governor Cuomo, that is, will reform this system?
Well, he has pledged to do so. He came out with a series of books in his previous election that listed hundreds of things he wanted to deal with. Number one on there was campaign finance reform, and that is the one outstanding issue which he hasn't handled in some way.
He didn't follow through on the redistricting, even though he was going to veto that bill.
He claims that he followed through on it because he passed a quote, reform proposal that didn't really change much, but did take it very slightly out of the hands of the state legislature. But ultimately, the lines 10 years down the road will probably look very similar to what we've seen in the past.
And your analysis seems to bear that out, right? That it didn't change much at all.
The lines that were passed this year for 2012
were actually
some of the worst that we've seen in decades.
Yeah.
The Senate's lines were clearly the most gerrymandered. But campaign finance, that is something that probably is a bigger issue in people's minds. Redistricting, people think about it every 10 years. But campaign finance, anytime somebody turns on a television set in the month of October, they're reminded that elections cost a lot of money and that mysterious groups are paying for this money. And I think that will be an issue, especially since it's gained increasing national it's become an increased center of the national discussion since Citizens United, that could be an issue that plays out in 2016. Now, I don't know if Governor Cuomo actually is interested in being involved in the federal elections in that year and running for president, but the common wisdom is that he is. And handling an issue like this, making New York State a leader on campaign finance, really could help him out there if he can point to this as one of his achievements, saying that he was the one governor who did the most to reform this broken system.
Well, you know, we'll have to see how that bears out. But of course, it's hard when you've already been running. The money came in for the last election, which may tie you to the money of the next election. So there's a lot of strings that go on, not just in New York, but in all states when it comes to incumbents and running and what they are already tied into.
Yeah, everybody who's in office likes to run saying that they'd like to fix problems such as campaign finance. But a lot of them, once they're in there, they really don't make it a priority. And they want to do what they can to make sure that they can keep on raising more money than their opponents. When they're in Albany for several months out of the year, they often have nothing to do at night except for host fundraisers where they can get the lobbyists to show up and give them money. And that will make it easier for them to dominate the airwaves come the next November. And that's not something that many of them are really interested in changing. And even the ones who do seek to change it, they've often found ways to introduce loopholes whenever they've talked about this. There were a couple of bills which floated around last session, which would have let incumbents who are currently serving keep their current war chest, which are often hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. It would have reformed the campaign finance system in some ways, but people who were already in office got to keep all the money that they had in the bank to run for re-election the next few cycles. And could, since their opponents then would be limited in how much they could raise, they could easily outspend them.
Is it a constant campaign on the state level like we see on the federal level where it doesn't seem that the campaigning ends for very long at all? They're always running for re-election, in other words.
Especially with incumbents. Everything they do is most of what they do is with an eye towards the next election cycle. They start fundraising as soon as a previous election wraps up, and they start doing what they can to make political attacks against the other party right away.
And what about political coalitions? I mean, I see here now the Senate Republicans have gained one more member in the fight for the control of the chamber. Newly elected Brooklyn Democrat Simca Felder says he will sit with the GOP. Now, we're all here waiting to find out two other races, the Saland race and the Amador Kachik race. Those two seem to be leaning towards the Democrats, Gibson and Kachik. So we don't know how the power structure will play out in terms of party who will control the Senate. But it already seems like the majority leader, Skelos, in the Senate has gotten a hold of Simca Felder and said, I'll give you what you need for your district. And he seems to agree he'll sit with the Republicans. So here's something right here that's making news. What do you think?
Yeah, at this point, we have no idea who's going to control the state Senate. As you mentioned, there's two races which are still undecided, and there are several Democrats who are counted in their column who very well could switch before January comes around. There have been rumors that Senator Malcolm Smith, who is a former majority leader of the Senate during the time when the coup happened a couple years ago, he apparently is
before amigos.
Yeah, he was apparently interested in running for New York City mayor next year as a Republican. Mm-hmm. So people have tossed around the idea, and a few reporters have said that people close to him have said that he's interested in flipping to the Republican Party and giving them the majority, so that way he can win over the county chairs come 2013. Now that's a rumor, but it has been reported, and anything's possible, as we've seen repeatedly in the Senate.
What do you make of the idea that citizens elect their representatives? Simca Felder will take, is elected. He is immediately put upon by the majority leader in his house. He is in the minority. And that power of the majority can put some influence and make him come around, let's say. Now, that happens on a lot of issues when freshman legislators come into the state capitol in Albany and they start out, let's say, on one side of the spectrum or the other, and they're forced to compromise because of how the power is distributed among the members. And to me, a lot of that power and a lot of those rules don't seem to fall within something called democracy.
Yeah, I think the best example of this was last year during a special election. A Buffalo Assembly candidate ran on an anti-Sheldon Silver platform. He basically attacked the Speaker of the State Assembly throughout his entire campaign. When he was elected, he was going to conference as a Democrat, but before doing so, Speaker Silver made him write a letter of apology that was made public to say that, I'm sorry for attacking you, I'm going to work with you going forward, and I won't keep on doing this. And that really does speak to the power of the leaders in the state capitol.
They can move you to a smaller office. They can take a desk away. There's all sorts of things they can do to punish you.
Yeah, I saw there is one state assembly member who ran against Speaker Silver about 8 years ago. It took him about 6 years to move out of the third floor of the state legislative office building, where the offices are the smallest. He still had one staffer who was part-time, and he didn't have the resources needed to work for his district effectively. Well, if you look at the people who are loyal to Speaker Silver and have stuck around for several years, they often have maybe a half dozen or more staffers in the state capitol. They have conference rooms and all the amenities they need, and even computers. I've heard stories from state Democrats when the Senate Republicans were in power who have said they've had one computer to share amongst their three staffers in their district office. Things like this, the resources are completely controlled by the central leaders, and it's a way to keep legislators in line.
It certainly is. We look at something that's coming forward now after Hurricane Sandy. The governor of New York has called for $30 billion in aid from the federal government to help New York survive what's happened here. Now, we're already hearing it's going to be years for many to get back to a normal state, and some won't probably be able to move back at all. So you add $30 billion into the equation, and depending on what the feds can do, what the state is going to have to do and how that's going to affect the budget process as we come into the next session in January. There's a lot now added to the plate of Governor Cuomo to get done. So if we look at this fight over the control of the state Senate, and for a moment we think about what would be better for the governor based on who's in control, is it better for the Democrats or is it better for the Republicans? If you follow this line of reasoning, that if things are going to go terribly wrong, the budget's going to get even further in debt, we're going to have more struggles to solve the problems we have in New York going forward, would it be good to have someone to blame?
Yeah, I think there would be a lot of advantages for Governor Cuomo if he had a Senate Republican majority. One, he's showed in the past couple of years that he can work with them and get things done. And if he is running for higher office in a few years, that would certainly be a great selling point for why he should be elected. The gridlock in Washington is probably the one place that's actually worse than the gridlock in the state capital of Albany, where the Republicans and the Democrats have just not been able to work together and get anything done. And if he's able to say that, hey, I worked with the Republican state Senate for several years and we got a lot of things done, look at all these great bills that we got passed, people might buy that. It could become a selling point for his campaign. But on the other hand, if things stop working, then yes, it's a lot easier for a Democratic governor to blame a Republican state Senate for messing everything up and bringing gridlock to the state capitol than it is for him to say, hey, look at those Democrats in the state Senate. That's not going to play well with primary voters.
We're talking with Bill Mahoney. He is the Legislative Operations and Research Coordinator for the New York Public Interest Research Group on the Capitol Connection with us this week. I'm David Gustina, filling in for Alan Shar Talk. Let me turn to something I think really has showed the strength of the governor, which is how he has dealt with Hurricane Sandy. We already see now he's forming a Moreland Act commission to investigate how the utilities are handling the situation. But let's relate it to NYPERG for a second. On your website, you talk about climate as one of the issues is very much in the forefront of NYPERG in terms of what you're looking at and citing studies that show that the temperatures have risen more so now than ever before. The planet is warming. And you saw something unique happen after Sandy. The governor came out in what I can only describe as the sort of very Cuomo-esque pragmatic way, much like his father did, and didn't go for the passionate argument, but went for the logical argument. He said, I don't want to talk about the politics of global warming. All I know is we've been hit by major storms in the last few years. The climate is changing. The sea is rising. We need to prepare for it. Now, to me, that, as sitting in your chair at NYPERG, would probably be one of the best things you could possibly hear when it comes to dealing with the climate.
Yeah, climate change isn't something that I work with much personally, but it certainly is something that really needs to be on people's minds. It wasn't an issue in the presidential election until the last week of the campaign. I believe when MTV finally asked the president a question about that, and it only really came up when Mayor Bloomberg began weighing in and saying that this is the most important issue facing the country. And it certainly is clear that the climate is changing. The vast majority, 99% of scientists who have looked into this, believe that this is due to human activity and that this could be stopped if humans change the way that we run some of our industries and regulate carbon emissions. But at the very least, it is changing. And there are a lot of simple solutions that we can do while rebuilding places like New York City that could reduce the harm of future inclement weather.
Sort of smart building is, you know, the way they go about it in terms of trying to design an area to meet the environmental challenges that are facing it. Then you have on the other side here, and speaking of elections and climate and environment, hydrofracking. And of course, this we're still waiting to see what the final decision will be. We know in those southern tier areas, those that supported hydrofracking were elected. And initially, the governor was talking about allowing maybe some limited in those areas where it was supported. However, he sort of backed off. They called for more hearings, more public comment, and they still haven't made a decision. But we're talking about the environment here and, you know, hydrofracking, which is very controversial. And certainly, he has been getting a lot of pushback on this issue.
Yeah, it's the one issue where he's shown the most sign of change so far in his administration. He initially came across as very favorable to it, but gradually, as you mentioned, there have been calls for more detailed analyses, and this is an issue which people have convinced him that he needs to seriously reconsider. It's clear that this is not the cleanest way to get energy to fuel our future, and this will bring harm to some local communities. They might make more money. Some property owners might, but everybody will be drinking polluted water. And this is not an issue which should be seen as a simple move forward. And this should be studied much more before anybody even considers putting out a proposal.
As the legislative director here of NYPERG and handling the operations of this group, Alan Shartok often says, you're a Google group. You're a good government group. You know, you wear the white hat, you have the pencil and the piece of paper, but your biggest arm to get your messages out is through the microphones, like you're sitting here today. But if you were, you know, sort of king for a day and you could make anything happen, any piece of legislation you'd like to see move through the New York State legislature that's on the NYPERG agenda, what would be your number one priority right now?
Well, from my narrow worldview, there's a lot of things that need to change in the New York State legislature. But the one thing that I think will lead to the most changes in other areas is campaign finance reform. Right now, politicians, as we've mentioned, raise a ton of money from a small group of special interests, and the agenda of what's discussed is often resulting solely from what these interests want them to deal with. So solving that one problem and taking away the outsized voice of just a few people in the state capitol could lead to all sorts of other problems being solved. Take climate change, for example, which we were just talking about. Average people who might care about the issue of global warming probably can't afford to write hundreds of thousands of dollars in checks every single year to their state elected officials. But an industry which might benefit from profiting from putting carbon into the atmosphere, they certainly can afford to write that sort of money. And every issue that comes across is in some way tied to campaign finance. Even something like pension reform for the state workers. Governor Cuomo and a lot of other elected officials complained before passing Tier 6 last year that this was way too long in coming. The state elected officials were getting an uneven amount of resources. And, you know, people have differing views on that. But the one thing that is very clear is that the state public employee unions were able to give a lot more in money than people who may have just philosophically thought that they were getting paid too much.
Mm-hmm. I have another question for you, because it comes up from time to time, and we see that part of any negotiations with the New York State legislature might actually involve giving the legislators a pay raise. Now, I believe their base salary is somewhere around $79,000, but we hear, of course, because of what are called Lulus or these extra perks they get when they have a committee assignment, they get travel expenses if they travel, things like that. Their salaries are often above $100,000 a year. Yeah. And, of course, many of these legislators have real estate businesses since they're part-time, or they're lawyers and attached to law firms. And, of course, we all know that that creates a successful situation for those businesses when they're a state legislator. My question to you is, why not make them full-time? They can't do anything else except serve the people of New York.
It's certainly an argument that has been raised. The drawback that a few of the legislators have pointed out is that it might actually make it a little bit harder if somebody's got a business which they manage, which they plan to just oversee part-time. It would make it tougher for people like that to actually run for the state capitol and for people who are involved in the community to get involved.
Too bad.
Yeah, too bad.
Get somebody else, one of your underlings to fill in.
Yeah, it certainly would go a long way toward reducing corruption. There are limits at the congressional level, which are much more strict than what we have seen at the state capitol. And those seem to have worked fairly well in terms of actually finding, in terms of not narrowing down the field of who is interested in running too much.
The other thing is, too, that we've seen, you know, the Four Amigos, and most of these people who were involved are doing jail time. They have been convicted on corruption charges. And one of the areas we see this most notably is when a legislator, especially in the New York City area, sets up a nonprofit that they're in charge of. So things like that, those kinds of rules and what legislators can do certainly need to be looked at, don't they?
Yeah, nonprofits and consulting firms are the other big one. A lot of them have these ambiguous consulting firms which they run, where the whole point is basically to have people with business before state government give them money to do work on their behalf, not just offer them advice, but to actually introduce bills and get money from the state budget for them. The ethics bill, which passed a little bit over a year ago, one of the best parts of that is the fact that going forward, starting next year, the ethics disclosure forms that state legislators will need to fill out will be more detailed than they ever have been before.
What's the loophole? Come on, Bill. What's the loophole there? What did they put in for a loophole?
Well, there are some problems with the system, but we will ultimately get to see how much these people, the state legislators, are actually getting paid for doing business, and a little bit more description of what they're actually doing. And once we start seeing these next May and June, we should be able to have a very clear idea of where the problems lie and which legislators might have some shady businesses on the side. And it'll be much easier to figure out what exactly needs to be changed going forward once we can look at that information for the first time ever.
You know, you have to believe that when certainly some of these legislators were convicted, there were a lot of other legislators shaking in their boots because they knew they probably engaged in some similar activities and were worried about themselves. So there may be some self-check there. But wouldn't you agree that when you're in power, you're less likely to vote for these things because it might be a detriment to you?
Yeah, it's obviously very tough for people to cast a vote to reduce how much money they can make. But as I mentioned, I think going forward, we can actually get a real grasp on this problem starting next year.
We've been speaking with Bill Mahoney. He's the Legislative Operations and Research Coordinator for the New York Public Interest Research Group. Bill, just a great pleasure to speak with you today. I really appreciate you being on the Capital Connection. We hope you'll come back.
Thank you.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. Ian Pickus is producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign. Online at nyscasa.org.